Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Fonterra 2020 Annual Results Investor Briefing. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the speaker's presentation, there will be a question and answer session. To ask a question during the session, you will need to press star one on your telephone. Please be advised that today's conference is being recorded. I will now hand the conference over to your first speaker today, Mr. Miles Hurrell, CEO for Fonterra. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. Welcome to our annual results presentation for 2020. I'm joined here today by our CFO, Mark Rivers. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge the great work that has gone on by our teams to manage what has been an unprecedented situation through COVID. Their hard work and resilience in help juggling the demands of COVID has certainly helped us in delivering this performance today. To start with, the net profit after tax, an increase of 1.3 billion to 659 million, which goes a long way to delivering upon all our promises we set out at the start of the year. In addition to our earnings, we've also had a higher milk price, delivering 7.14 dollars per kilogram of milk solids for the year just finished, which puts about 11 billion dollars into the economy. When I look from an environmental perspective, hitting our 2020 energy intensity target, which was set in 2003, is something we also are very proud of. Our underlying business performance has improved. Normalized NPAT was up 118 million dollars to 382 million dollars, being 0.24 per share, being at the top end of our guidance range. Also reduced by 1.1 billion. This is important to delivering our commitment to reducing our leverage and strengthening our balance sheet. On top of delivering our performance for the year and our priorities, we've also announced a dividend this morning of 0.05 per share to be paid on 15th of October. This was achieved while navigating the global pandemic through the second half of the year. While Mark will take us through the details, I briefly want to touch on how we've responded through COVID. It's undoubtedly a tough environment for most, and the global dairy market has brought increased volatility and uncertainty. Despite this, we've performed well. As an essential business, we continue to operate through the lockdown. The health and safety of our people was paramount and our number one priority, and our teams around the world are all at different stages of managing COVID. We've also been providing our people clarity on what the co-op's up to. This has meant they know what they need to do to minimize the risk of further spread while ensuring our business continues to operate. The work done in the last 18 months to strengthen our balance sheet was timely and allowed us to focus on managing the COVID-19 situation. Many of our markets in which we do business are prone to sudden shocks and can impact where, when, and what we sell. However, the global nature of COVID is something we've never experienced before. So far, demand for dairy has proven resilient, and we're drawing on our global supply chain and using a diverse product and customer base to direct milk into those products and markets where the most value can be achieved. We remain agile, and we're doing everything to ensure we're prepared for any challenges that may arise through the global pandemic. I'll now ask Mark to take us through some of the detail.
Thank you, Miles. Our 2020 financial year really is a game of two halves, but we focused on what mattered, and that's reflected in the results. If I sum up 2020, it'd be like this. Gross profit up 200 million. Food service business had a very strong first half, driven by Greater China, but was then partially by the emergence of COVID in the second half. Balancing this, our ingredients business, after having a stable first half, benefited from favorable product pricing relativities between reference and non-reference during the second half, and overall had an improved performance relative to the prior year. We came in at the top end of our normalized EPS range, and that included a number of adverse significant items that we did not normalize, and these reduced our normalized profit after tax by 104 million or 0.06 per share. We've maintained our focus on strong financial discipline. CapEx for the year was 419 million, which is 181 million down from last year and 81 million below our target of not more than 500 million for the year. Total group normalized operating expenses reduced slightly. This is a good result, bearing in mind last year benefited from not paying any employee performance incentives. We also completed key asset sales in the first half of 2020 financial year. DFE Pharma and Foodspring, and they generated cash proceeds of 623 million and a gain on sale of 467 million. They contributed a significant reduction in our debt and strengthening our balance sheet. Our return on capital has improved from 5.8% to 6.7%. The improvement came from a result really of increased earnings as well as lower capital employed. So all of our group financial metrics have improved. Let me just go over the things we've not covered off yet. Our total group sales revenue increased 5% or $1.1 billion to $21 billion, and that's driven by improved ingredients pricing as well as product mix. But also worth noting, Greater China food service business, which contributed an additional $166 million in revenue in spite of the disruption from COVID. Our normalized EBIT increased $67 million or 8% to $879 million, and the improved performance from ingredients and food service both contributed increase. Free cash flow increased by $733 million to $1.8 billion, and we achieved that through the improved earnings, lower capital expenditure, as well as the sales proceeds from divesting DFE Pharma and FoodSpring, as well as the reduction that we've been making gradually on our Being Mate shareholding. Our main measure of leverage is the ratio of the debt to EBITDA, which improved from 4.4 times to 3.4 times, and that's well below our target of 3.75 for the year. This year marks a return to paying dividends, a position we expect to maintain in the future, assuming normal operating conditions. And at 5 cents per share, the dividend is at the lower end of the 5 to 7 cent range that's calculated under our board's dividend policy guidelines. And so in the context of so much uncertainty as COVID-19 continues to impact our key markets and customer confidence, distributing a 5 cent dividend is a prudent decision and one that balances our aims of further reducing debt and distributing earnings. We've come a long way from last year with a $1.2 billion improvement in profit after tax. And just note here, referring to profit after tax attributable to equity holders, so after non-controlling interests. If we just start on the left, this time last year, we had a reported loss after tax of $562 million, and that included $826 million of impairments and other costs, which after normalizing resulted in FY19's normalized profit after tax of $264 million. This year, our underlying business performance improved with $222 million of higher after-tax operating earnings. Key drivers that improved performance were $200 million increase in gross profit, as I mentioned before. We've decreased our net finance cost 21% from $418 million to $332 million on the back of lower average debt and lower interest rates. Offsetting this improved operating performance were some adverse significant items of $4 million, and they included $57 million impairment of intangible asset values. One is a $36 million brand impairment on our Chesdell brand. This is shared between our Greater China and Asia consumer businesses. And the other was a $21 million goodwill impairment on New Zealand consumer business. There's also a $28 million provision for a potential payment relating to holiday pay. This is pending judicial interpretation of the requirements of legislation in New Zealand. And lastly, when we completed the closure of our German trading entity, we're required to release the related foreign currency translation reserve to the income statement, and that's an additional loss of $19 million. So the net improvement to our normalized profit after tax was $118 million, with normalized profit after tax for the 2020 financial year of $382 million. This equates to 24 cents per share, an 8 cent improvement in normalized EPS compared to last year. So in order to just show the underlying performance of the business, we also had some normalized items. We had positive normalized items of $549 million, the main ones coming from DFE, $427 million, FoodSpring, $66 million, and Being Mate, $50 million. Some negative normalized items total $245 million. The main ones are China Farms, $63 million, DPA Brazil, $45 million, and China Farming JV, $65 million. So in total, normalized items were a net positive $304 million, and more detail is provided in the appendix of the presentation. Including normalized items, our total group reported profit after tax attributable to equity holders is $686 million, and that equates to 43 cents per share. We've moved to our new operating model in the course of the year, but we are reporting our segment performance on the same basis as the interim results. Next year, we'll report on the new operating model. Looking at the business segment's performance, first of all, ingredients. The ingredients had an improved performance. Total ingredients gross margin increased from 8.9% to 9.3% thanks to a favorable product mix and pricing in the second half of the financial year. This led to Ingredients normalized gross profit increasing $165 million to $1.6 billion, with all three businesses contributing to that increase. New Zealand up $131 million, thanks to favorable price relativities. Australia Ingredients up $22 million due to Dennington closure savings, better product mix and utilization on our Stanhope site. And also Chile Ingredients, which improved $13 million thanks to improved product pricing. Operating expenses increased 3%. That reflects the FY19 benefit of no performance incentives. And so we're left with EBIT from ingredients from continuing operations increasing $37 million or 5% to $827 million despite prior year. So this includes $44 million of earnings from now divested DFE that was included in last year's results. Food service also had improved performance, with its full-year EBIT up 14% to $209 million, thanks to a very strong first half. EBIT in the first half was $148 million. EBIT in the second half reduced to $61 million due to the impact of COVID-19-related restrictions, is particularly evident in the fourth quarter. The strong first half was driven by Greater China and Asia due to recovery in butter margins and selling more higher gross margin products, such as Anchor Food Professionals, whipping cream, and cream cheese. Within Greater China, COVID-19 impacted early in the third quarter, but rebounded quickly. During the fourth quarter, parts of China have still been impacted by COVID-19 outbreaks, which has hampered a complete recovery, but much closer to 100%. Asia and the Oceania markets, however, were significantly impacted in the fourth quarter by the risk to manage the pandemic. Our consumer business EBIT was down. However, it included $57 million of impairments that we did not normalize. The impairments are the ones I've already mentioned before and relate to Fonterra Brands New Zealand and our Chesdale brand. If we adjust for those impairments, our EBIT for the year is down $21 million, and mainly due to the challenging market conditions that we experienced in Hong Kong and Chile. Gross profit declined $77 million from Greater China, which is down $31 million because of the challenging market conditions in Hong Kong. Oceania gross profit reduced $26 million, mainly due to Tip Top being included in last year's results. And of course, you know that that's a business that we sold in the course of 2019. Not included in the consumer results is DPA Brazil, which is held for sale and meets the definition of a discontinued operation. However, DPA Brazil's EBIT increased $29 million due to a strong first half performance and growth in market share. Excluding impairments and including discontinued EBIT, consumer earnings is up $7 million on last year.
Great. Thanks, Mark. Certainly a lot of information to take in, but we measure success through three interconnected goals, those being healthy business, healthy people, and healthy environment. So in addition to the healthy business information that Mark's provided, I want to share our progress against the healthy people and a healthy environment metrics. We've already mentioned $11 billion flown into the New Zealand economy by way of milk price. But we've also supported things through a nutritional program such as Kickstart Breakfast, which celebrated its 10th year this year. And during COVID-19, we also got stuck in and helped communities and customers manage that pandemic, such as redirecting 2 million litres of ethanol to support the use of hand sanitizer, and also extending our production season at Hautapu to support the hydrolysate business with some of our key customers offshore for those customers impacted by COVID. If I look at the healthy side of the equation, we've also made good progress as we look to reduce our environmental footprint. The progress I talk about regarding our energy efficiency targets, we've reduced our energy intensity across our manufacturing sites by 20% since our 2003 baseline. We've also looked to support our farmers with farm environment plans. Up to 34% of our farmers will have a farm environment plan this year, up from 23% last year. And also farmers will be provided with an on-farm emission report, which will help them make their own decisions to support their sustainability journey. But the big news this week we've also announced is the introduction of wood pellets into our Te Ao Mutu boiler, reducing our national coal use by around 10%. If I look at our targets for the 2021 season ahead, I look at it through three lenses. Firstly, the cooperative, where we need to continue to drive a strong milk price for our farmer shareholders, but also supporting our teams and empowering them to get on and make it happen. If I think about performance, continue to drive a return on capital greater than 6%, continue to focus on our debt to EBITDA position to be no more than 3 to 3.5 times. and also looking to our earnings guidance for the year of 20 to 35 cents. If I start talking about the outlook for the year ahead, global dairy prices can be challenging to forecast at the best of times, and COVID adds significant uncertainty into the process of forecasting that will happen with global dairy prices over the coming year. With both increasing demand and increasing supply, we'll see dairy prices outlook as finely balanced in the year ahead, which is why we maintain our range of $5.90 to $6.90. We've also set our earnings guidance of 20 to 35 cents. It is difficult to predict movements in the global pandemic and whether we'll see a re-emergence in our key trading markets. We're currently assuming lockdowns will ease and greater China and Asia markets will continue to improve. We're anticipating improved trading performance in Asia Pacific food service and consumer, particularly continued growth throughout Australia. We're not assuming the levels of favourable price relativities we received in the second half of the 2020 financial year will be repeated in the current year, and we've already seen these narrow. Offsetting the reduced pricing relativities is the assumption we'll have less adverse significant items and lower interest and tax expenses. To conclude this part of the presentation, I'd like to say I'm proud of what the team has performed in the last financial year, and I believe we're well positioned to face 2021. Thanks for listening, and we're now happy to open for questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question today, please press star followed by one on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press the pound or hash key. Your first question comes on the line of Ari Decker from Jarden. Please ask your question.
Oh, good afternoon. Yeah. Firstly, could you just provide an update on the expected timing at the moment for the two sales processes you have underway, and just any colour you can give there with regards to whether they'll be completed this calendar year in particular?
Yeah, hi, Ari, Miles here. It's our intention that they will be concluded this year. It's fair to say the China Farms discussions are further advanced. I think we had a bit of hold up through COVID with Brazil that hasn't been as far advanced as China Farms, but certainly our intention is to move on those two this financial year.
Sure, and then just in terms of the capital structure, it looks like you've made progress there framing up and now sort of into the analysis of that. Can you just sort of give an indication of, if you can, when you think final outcomes on that will be kind of available to provide colour on?
Let me speak that, Ari. Hey, good afternoon. I guess on timing, it's difficult to put any timing on it. I think the feeling with the board is we want to take whatever time is needed to go through it. There's certainly an appreciation of, as John said this morning at the media conference, there's no silver bullet. And what we have now actually has a lot of strengths and good attributes. And so, what's important is that we've go through at the beginning here of identifying, what are the key principles in play, what are the criteria that would be used to think through and assess different possible capital structures, including and always comparing against what we have now. And it's also clear that whatever changes we would make need to have a strong rationale for why we'd make any change compared to what we've got. So it's complex stuff, and there's an appreciation for that. And so we'll take whatever time is needed.
Clearly there'll be a consultation process through this, and no doubt you're correct. Planning on sort of taking farmers along for it. When do you think you might sort of open up to the wider farmer base and sort of present some of those sort of options and a first sort of look at what your thinking is?
Still too early to say, Ari, in terms of when we'd be in a position to do that. But no doubt, once we are, then we'd want to do consultation for sure with all the stakeholders that are involved, farmer base, government, unit holders, et cetera. So, we'll as soon as we're that far along.
Sure. And then just in terms of the investment focus for 2021, I think, you know, you've sort of signaled that you're going to have some catch-up CapEx in the envelope this year, and it looks like you've made an allowance for some investment over and above the core CapEx. Can you just sort of talk to where your investment priorities this year are?
Sure. So we expect CapEx to be closer to around 600 or so in the new year. But within that, you know, the primary focus still is around the essential CapEx. You know, there were some projects we would have liked to have gotten to in the course of the year that we weren't able to because of the COVID impact. And so we want to catch up on some of that and the basically shift that into 21. A little bit of allowance for some investment capital, but the vast majority is around maintaining what we've got.
Sure. And then just in terms of as you come to the end of these phase one exits this year, is there anything else on the table in terms of, you know, non-core businesses coming out of sort of, you know, or products coming out of your portfolio review over the last couple of years? Or is sort of a completion of the capital structure review kind of the precursor to making any more decisions on that front?
Well, firstly, there is nothing else on the docket that we need to move on in terms of asset sales, is your first question. But certainly, as we've, I think, alluded before, you know, we need to have a dynamic approach to our portfolio. So, you know, while I'd like to think we're through our reset or on the backside of that reset we set out a year or two ago, that doesn't mean that we won't continue to assess our portfolio of assets. And we certainly wouldn't be waiting for any outcome of a capital structure before we move forward and continue to execute our current strategy. So that will run in parallel to us running the business. So we're certainly not sitting waiting for anything.
Oh, that's great. Hey, thanks for that, Keller. Thank you.
Good. Thanks, Ari.
Your next question today comes on the line of Chelsea Ledbetter from Forsyth Barr. Please ask your question.
Thanks, and hi, Miles and Mark. I guess maybe just starting off with respect to the consumer and food service side of the business, and obviously you've given us a reasonable amount of colour about kind of what's happened so far, and obviously I appreciate the world's moving pretty quickly, but I guess I'm just trying to understand a little bit more about what you've factored into your guidance range, kind of particularly maybe thinking about the top end versus the bottom end, and I guess ultimately any colour you can provide on how the year has started in terms of FY21?
A couple of things I think we called it out. It's Chelsea, it's Miles here. A couple of things we called out was we need to see a return of sorts in Greater China and Asia in terms of food service and consumer. So, you know, we're performing very well in China from a food service perspective. The rest of, I guess, Southeast Asia hasn't quite got to back to where we need to, but we're expecting things to progress at the same rate as we've seen in China recently. So feeling okay about that. We're expecting on a consumer side, Hong Kong, we'd like to see some movement on the political situation in Hong Kong and open up some more stability in that market, although at the same time, you know, wouldn't hold our breath that that's going to turn around anytime soon. But we'd like to see that move on. We've got some growth obviously planned for Chile and feeling pretty good about where that's at its current trajectory as well. So there's certainly some growth that we need to come through. Obviously a month and it's a bit early to get too much colour other than to say that nothing has hit us in the first 6 weeks or so that we hadn't foreseen. So we're feeling okay at this early stage. Probably a bit closer to home, you would have seen in the results. I mean, Australia and New Zealand have had very, very strong performances last year, notwithstanding that impairment in New Zealand, but a very, very strong performance in the consumer side. And any downside in food service we saw certainly being picked up by consumers, so feeling okay about those markets and expecting that to continue and don't see any slowdown in the retail space in New Zealand or Australia at the moment.
All right, no, I appreciate the extra colour. And I guess just thinking about the supply chain just more broadly, obviously it's been a pretty volatile year in terms of getting product where it needs to be. But in terms of access to freight capacity, you know, cost of it, getting it everything where it needs to be, and can you just give us some context on how you're finding that whole supply chain dynamic at the moment?
Yeah, I put a bit of flavour in that in the press conference this morning. I'm not sure if you saw, but that partnership with Kotahi and Maersk is really paying dividends now in terms of the support we're getting from that partnership. In fact, I was talking to the CEO of Kotahi last night. We had a very, very good first half of the year from that business in terms of delivery performance and on-time delivery and container availability and some of the metrics that they work to. And what was amazing is that the second half of the year was even better than the first half. So I'd struggle to find another exporter anywhere in the world that would have a delivery performance like that we've seen through Kotahi in the second half against a backdrop of COVID. So very, very pleased with how that's gone, which is great.
Yep, no, definitely great to hear. And I guess just last question from me, in terms of your 3-year and your 5-year plan, obviously that you've set out through this whole strategic change sort of period and phase that you've gone through, can you just give us an update? Has anything changed in terms of, I guess, your targets or the way you're thinking about things, I guess particularly given the backdrop's changed quite dramatically over the past 6 months or so?
Yeah, I'll tell you, Chelsea, it's Mark. I think the short answer is no. Those continue to be good targets, good aspirations for us to strive towards. This year's results are very much along the lines of what we intended. In fact, in some places, even better. So we're feeling comfortable with that in light of the backdrop. As you mentioned, COVID certainly is something to factor in. It's unclear exactly what the macroeconomic consequences will be, what that means for purchasing power and the like. But what we've seen in the course of this year is, just a little bit the inherent, strength in the construct is having that diversity of markets that we can turn to, the optionality and flexibility we have in terms of what we turn the milk into, that gives us some comfort to be able to ride through that. And maybe there's even opportunity that comes out of COVID as a direct result. It'll be interesting to see what sort of consumer trends we start to see. Maybe there's a greater appreciation for the role of health and nutrition. And there's certainly, to the extent that becomes true, there's certainly a role to play, I think, for reliable, healthy, food source. So maybe there's even opportunity that comes out of that for us.
Yeah, the first part of the question was, where do we sit with those longer term targets? And those aspirations and goals still remain. We will probably see a few movements within that as things have changed. And, one very small part, which is not material in the grand scheme of things, but we had plans to start thinking about what does our food service business in the US look like at the start of this year. How do we start to go down a food service trajectory? Capital light by using third-party manufacturing potentially in that market. I mean, clearly that food service market's taken a massive hit on the back of COVID. So, yeah, we'll redirect the attention. So there's a couple of small things that we may turn our energies in different parts, but there's nothing at this stage to suggest that those goals aren't on our radar.
All right. Thanks for the colour. Appreciate it.
And your next question today comes on the line of Marcus Curley from UBS. Please ask your question.
Good afternoon, guys. I've got three topics if I can. Just first on the New Zealand ingredients business, can you just talk to what was the level of stream return in FY20 relative to FY19?
Sure. Hey, Marcus, good afternoon. I would say in terms of level of stream returns we saw in F20, probably about two times what we saw last year in F19, something on that level. So, and most of that came in the second half of the year, Marcus.
And the guidance would assume that reverts back to a normalized level in 21?
That's correct. That's correct, Marcus. Yeah, we factored in for F21. I don't think we can expect, as a in the baseline, to a repeat of that level of stream return. That was a confluence of some unusual things. It would certainly be nice if that to pass, but we're not going to sort of count on that in there. It's better defect then. So we kind of go back, look at the historical average and bring it back to a more normal, as a starting point at least, and we'll see how the year unfolds.
Understood. And are you willing to call out what that delta is, you know, for FY21 in terms of dollars?
Yeah, so maybe to put it in context, I think when we had this year was 2x what we had in 19, and 19 was also favorable, probably about twice the level of what we would see if you look out over a sort of 10 to 15 year average, say something like that, and that's just taking into account where there have been some years where it's gone absolutely negative on us. So when you balance all that out, I think, assuming something less than what we had in 19 would be a reasonable as a starting point.
Okay. Secondly, can you talk to what was potentially happening within non-reference product pricing in the fourth quarter? Yeah, when I look at it, it does look like prices came back. We hadn't necessarily seen that trend in the market. I just wondered if there was, something you're willing to call out on, what was happening with non-reference prices in terms of your achieved price.
I think, at a high level, Marcus, it's Miles here. At a high level, just when we started to see COVID kick in, there's certainly uncertainty in the market and what that was intending to do. So we just saw a little bit of softening through GDT on sort of the reference products, and I think that went some way to just softening, obviously the milk price, but we held up the cheese and protein prices accordingly. So that's probably more of a sort of a high level strategic response, I think, that. Because there was a thought process, come January, February, that drought was starting to bite, that was counteracted pretty quickly by way of, COVID and the uncertainty that brought into the market. So we saw milk prices just soften a little bit, which countered, but that didn't flow through to cheese and protein prices, which we managed to hold up.
We did see casein go up, pretty nicely towards the second half of. Right around that time in the middle of the year, came back a little bit in Q4. So maybe that's probably what you're seeing is a little bit of that. But broadly, what Miles just described is what's played out. The movement has been more on the whole milk powder, the reference products that kind of lowered, and then we were able to maintain more or less the non-reference revenues.
And then just finally on ingredients, you flagged an asset beta change in the milk price formula. Could you give us any color on the magnitude of that?
That's mentioned in the ComCom report that's one of the aspects that they're least happy with, I suppose, within that. So asset beta is something that will be looked at in the coming year. Hang on a second, Marcus. Let me just see if I can get you a number for that. Go ahead, Simon. You can say it.
So, Marcus, you're looking to see what the impact could potentially be through to the milk price of that change?
Yeah, well, I've read the milk price manual and it says that you're bringing forward the asset beta change to FY21 season, but it was at the time of printing the manual, you couldn't work out what it was. I just wondered whether you come to that decision now in terms of what asset beta you're planning on implementing in the current milk price season.
Yeah, it's not a major move, Marcus. In that.
I think we can take that away and just clarify if we have noted that at this early stage. What I will say, Mark, is though, it is already included in our guidance from the earnings perspective. It's probably the most important thing. But if we have disclosed it at this early stage, I'm sure the team can share that in due course.
Okay. And then just on the dividend policy, you obviously came in at the low end, as a starting point for the second half. Do you think that's a reasonable indicator for where, this year plays out, given the desire to continue to reduce debt levels?
I'll give a quick view. We certainly have more work to do on that debt, which we've explained. We've obviously got our earnings guidance for the year, and we have those asset sales that are advancing as referred earlier. So I'd like to think we can get to a position of resuming dividends on a more regular basis going forward without sort of being too cute about it, Marcus. But I think we decided to take a prudent approach this year to signal that we are back in dividend mode, but also to go low end of our guidance on that in terms of our policy, given we still have a little bit more work to do around our asset sales and therefore our balance sheet.
Okay. So, post asset sales, you know, there's a chance that it sort of trends back to a higher level as a percentage of payout.
Yeah, I think that's fair. So that 20 to 35 cents EPS, that represents, you know, normalized underlying earnings, and we should be in a position to apply the 40 to 60%, you know, to be able to distribute about half of that out in dividends. Obviously, at the point in time, you know, any board, you're going to look at what the circumstances are in terms of the overall environment and everything. So that's sort of always the caveat there. But that's the intent, absolutely.
And lastly, you've announced a new operating model. Could you just provide a bit of rationale behind why you're consolidating the ingredients business into the consumer food service businesses?
I wouldn't perceive it as a consolidating it in, as we just wanted to have one front-facing model in each of our markets. As we think about strategic intent, selling the New Zealand story or the provenance and what goes behind our products, to have one lens in a market to sell that is something that we feel is important to us. There are parts of our business where there's probably a fine line in some cases between an ingredient and a food service when you get into maybe an industrial bakery type thing. So from our perspective, to make sure we have one lens across to ensure we can extract the most value is something that we think is really important. And the other side, which is not so much about cutting the pie a different way, but to have, recognising that milk is flat now for the foreseeable future, that the milk growth that we've seen over the last decade and more, those days we believe are long gone, and therefore are in a situation where with a finite resource and no longer going hard on a milk pool strategy, we believe getting really close to customers and understanding their needs so we can extract more value for that limited resource is something that we feel really is critical for us, hence the reason we put those three key regions, three key senior roles that sit on my lead team in market.
So I can understand, Miles, that from a sales perspective. I suppose on the flip side, how do you balance that with, a return on capital discipline, especially in the ingredients business? And how do you balance with the visibility of how, how to forecast earnings, when you're consolidating the stuff up?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. So historically, that volatility that sits in stream returns historically has all sit under Goji. The way that we're structured now is if you get your transfer pricing clear with each of the regions and have that volatility sit within one segment here back in NZ, it becomes even more transparent to us and, of course, investors. So we think having one area of volatility, if that makes sense, to sit centrally is important. So it'll be clearer for externals to actually understand that going forward.
And you can be sure, Marcus, just internally, the way we're managing the business is very much with a return on capital mindset. It's that New Zealand milk going out, whatever region it goes to, the whole central portfolio management lens through that is to get the most valuable form of product in whatever market that ends up in to get the best possible return on that New Zealand milk. And then likewise for any segments or parts of the business which are different milk pool outside of, New Zealand milk, same principle applies. Are we generating returns on those investments, et cetera? And core to the strategy is really a focus, just a recognition that our primary mission is to collect the New Zealand milk and get as much value for it and bring it back home. And any other business needs to stand on its own from a return on capital perspective.
And Mark will be obviously looking to provide that level of disclosure in the new model as well, right, in terms of that total operating.
That's right. When you look in the results, you'll see in the segment notes a glimpse of what the new segment reporting would look like. And so in F21, we'll report on that basis. We're not going to continue with the old segment reporting. This is a bit of a hybrid year where you'll see both. But 21 forward, it'll be with the new model. It's a different way of looking at the business. But certainly those same principles apply, and we should have good discussions around that.
Yeah, I suppose when I look at the new disclosure regime, yeah, what you're sort of suggesting is that the business is more integrated. If you're consolidating it down, so there's one cost of goods sold, which incorporates ingredients and consumer and food service in a particular region.
Mark, just to interrupt you. That's not correct. Well, so within each region, there is a head of ingredients, there's a head of food service, consumer. You have kind of those kind of, in other words, the businesses within the regions,
the channels,
let's say. I wouldn't understand that as. It's all one cost of goods.
Okay, we maybe take it offline. Thank you.
Yeah.
There are no further questions on the line today. I would now like to hand the call back to Miles for closing remarks.
Great. Thanks everyone for making the time to dial in. Of course, the team, Simon and Phil and the team here are available, of course, for any questions that you may have following, but very much appreciate you making the time and for your support this last 12 months. Thank you.
Thank you.